Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are recording late on a Monday night, which is not our usual, but for reasons we will explain here in a bit, everything is a bit off its usual this week, this weekend. And so we have conspired to come together from assorted parts and places to bring you another excellent episode of Bombshell. Before we dig in, shall we identify what we are drinking? Are we in the melatonin phase of the evening, ladies? Are we in the sleepy time tea? What do we have here?
Is melatonin code for wine?
No.
I'm in the wine phase, guys.
You're in the wine phase. That's good to know. Lauren, what are you drinking?
I'm also in the wine phase. This is my second event of the evening, so I'm still drinking wine from that.
I have moved from the wine phase of the evening to the bourbon phase of the evening. Mm-hmm. I have some Walcott bourbon that I picked up at Total Wine in Delaware, which is fast becoming my favorite place that I stopped through on my way up to Maine over the weekend where I am for this week. So
I will say that, like, I told my husband this morning, I felt like I was hungover, but like from news instead of alcohol. It's just like over.
My hangovers are always from alcohol. It's not a mystery over here.
I definitely feel as though everything is just slower right now in terms of my body, not in terms of the news.
Yeah.
The more news there is, the worse my body just kind of deteriorates.
Yes. My of the many great tweets / memes over the last however many days, one of my favorites has been, I thought the October surprise referred to one surprise and not a new surprise every day. And that seems to at least have summed up the first several days of October. So for those who may have been living under a rock or blissfully have been on Mars or the moon, the president of the United States was diagnosed with COVID-19 virus at some point last week and then was admitted to Walter Reed Hospital over the weekend. Here on Monday night, he has just returned to the White House, and this has affected every element of news coverage, news consumption, political punditry, et cetera, in the nation's capital and elsewhere for the last at least 96 hours, if not full week. And so we thought we'd kind of revisit a number of our topics from the last several months as we think about how COVID-19 affects the world and American foreign policy and national security. But maybe we can start with, you know, what stories have we missed because we've been focused on COVID-19 over the last few days or over the last few months? What would we normally be talking about on this episode of Bombshell if we weren't somewhat fixated on the president's health and transmission of COVID-19 to key White House aides?
So, Erin, I'll let you talk about this because I just loved how you just framed this comment of Erin has this great way of talking in parentheses sometimes, and her parenthetical was that, oh, by the way, there's a war going on in Nagorno-Karabakh, which I don't even know if I say that right. That's one of those words that I've never said out loud. I've only ever read before. So even if it's not, don't tell me. Just let it go.
Yes, Lauren adores the way that in text I try to indicate the way that I talk in real life, and I have a number of ways of doing this. Her favorite of which is actually the way I indicate break, break, which is with two slant lines, which Slack doesn't like because it thinks you're giving it a command. But anyway, there is an actual shooting war occurring in the Nagorno-Karabakh region, which is between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Turkey is involved as there is sort of longstanding hostility between Turkey and Armenia. I don't have a lot of details on this. Everything I heard about this was on BBC NewsHour when I was driving up I-95 on Friday. But this is a classic to me sort of story that, like, has the potential to escalate, could benefit from some amount of various, you know, it involves a NATO member potentially given the role that Turkey appears to be playing. Perhaps also involves some fighters who have been in Syria. That's a fascinating plot line, right, Radha? So, you know, all of these things, and it is getting bupkis in terms of coverage. I mean, who even knows that it's happening? Who could care? I mean, nothing. So that's definitely in the, like, near-term story that would be getting maybe not all the headlines, but at least, like, Georgia circa 2008-level headlines, and we're not even really paying attention to it.
So mine is, guys, no deal Brexit.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like, that's like so a thing that could happen with the ancillary excitement of the potential solution to no deal Brexit is putting immigration infrastructure along the Irish border, which in and of itself could provoke, you know, all sorts of anything from violence to secession to question mark exclamation point. And I would have more to say on it, but I haven't had time to read about it.
Lauren, what story have you been vaguely paying attention to, wishing we had more time to think about?
I'll mention two categories because I think we've adapted well to one and not the other. So one, it's not a specific story. It's more a category of stories around refugees and displaced people. And I mention this because there's if we had the ability to travel, if one had the ability to travel and actually go places and investigate stories in person, that would be the sort of story where you had to be there in some ways to understand the actual size and impact of anything. But because we don't have the ability to travel, journalists don't, and to some degree, a lot of activists and aid groups cannot. There's a lot that is going on below the radar in Syria and the Middle East in particular, but also to some degree in South Central America, stemming off of Venezuela and other areas there that maybe not at a crisis level, but it's certainly at a level that we'd be paying more attention to if we had the ability to study these sorts of stories in person. But then conversely, like, I think it's interesting with everything that's going on in China with regard to the Uyghurs and the detention camps and other mechanisms that the Chinese have set up. We still managed to get halfway decent coverage of that. And I think it's because we've adapted to covering the Chinese without access so well. Like you have sources, you have other things, satellite coverage, other things that help people or have people decided to make a priority of understanding what's going on in that area, even if we don't have on the ground access and knowledge. Both of those are probably still in the category of things that we'd probably be paying a hell of a lot more attention to if COVID was not going on.
Yeah, the Uyghurs story is an interesting one there, Lauren, both in terms of the denied access, but also probably a committed effort by activists, both local and their links then to international organizations to get that story out, and the importance of that local to international bridge on these sorts of things. I had two other stories that I was just, you know, in the back of my mind. One is the FY21 budget. Like, I think we signed a continuing resolution last week.
I actually don't know, because wasn't it that night that we were like, oh, the president?
Yes, I don't know either. You know, our friends didn't get sent home from work, so there was not a shutdown, as best I can tell. But the night that it was supposed to be signed, the president went to the hospital. So I agree. Like, it's a greater example for why you shouldn't procrastinate. I mean, you just never know when you might get the COVID and have to go get supplemental oxygen, maybe. So, you know, it's a good example there.
What's amazing about that also, Aaron, is this has happened a number of times now. I mean, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, in that sort of circumstance, there would have been all kinds of guidance going out to federal employees being like, if this isn't signed, then you don't come in, and the furloughs and blah, blah, blah. And now people are really kind of like, there's not a budget? Okay, yeah, all right, fine. Because this is just normal
it's
now.
So true.
There's a lot of like angels on a pin, you know, sorts of discussions. But at some point, it's like, are you or are you not allowed to come to work? Which,
right.
You know, the other story that's in the back of my mind and came up to the forefront a little bit in some NatSec Twitter circles last week, I think, is the START Treaty and really arms control more generally and the utter collapse thereof. But in particular, this last one, this really big one, this agreement we have between the United States and Russia on strategic arms limitations, and that will basically expire early in 2021, unless we just all both mutually agree to extend the exact current terms. I mean, it is like the easiest, easy button of arms control extension of all time, and we are dithering about it for reasons that I'm aware of, but finding completely inane. So, but not generating a lot of discussion, there's no discussion of it in the presidential, you know, campaign circles. There's no discussion of it on Capitol Hill, as best I can tell. There's no pressure on the administration really to continue it outside of kind of the professional coterie of arms control experts. And so, you know, maybe we'll just expire and then there'll be zero limits on the strategic warheads of the United States or the Russia, you know, like just however you like. Any other stories that we missed? I mean, we just blatantly missed. Like, we literally don't know if there's been a CR. Anything else that we think wish we'd paid more attention to in the last week / 3 months? No?
Yeah.
Excellent. So, Lauren, you asked an excellent question as we were preparing for this episode of what topic has gotten increased attention or has, you know, benefited from some attention in the last. And again, this is sort of few days, few weeks, however we choose to interpret this. What is your preferred answer to that question?
I mean, this is a very local response, but it applies so much more broadly, and that is the digital divide in terms of access to internet that is constantly there and access to a device that has the ability to get on the internet consistently. I mean, I see this, as I know so many of you do, in our schools trying to figure out how do you have school for kids who don't have a computer at home or don't have access to Wi-Fi while the libraries are closed and so on. And there's all sorts of like both good and really depressing innovations going on in this space in terms of being able to stand that up. But it's not like it is very much a local issue for me and the kids in my school. But like I know it's also a national issue in terms of there's some communities that simply do not have the same kind of internet access, regardless of wealth or status or economic economic level of any kind. And then also certainly countries that have different varying levels of internet access. In some ways, actually, a lot of countries that went handled their internet, Wi-Fi, and cell infrastructure quite differently than the United States are in some ways better off than we are. And in other countries, they're still quite struggling a bit. So that was the one that struck me as the getting better attention and maybe also some better innovation as a result.
Rada, what struck you as something that was getting more attention that was well-deserved?
I have been increasingly surprised and impressed by the degree to which people are starting to think about and understand test sensitivity versus test specificity and the reliability of multiple repeated test statistics drawn non-randomly from samples in the population. So I think like basically we're all just spending a lot of time thinking about what testing often, testing with error-prone tests and testing repeatedly the same person using the same kind of error-prone tests means, and like what that means is slipping through the cracks. And we've seen it. I've seen people focused on it for the purpose of understanding when the president might have known he was positive. But I've also seen a lot of discussion of it in the context of schools and how often we should repeatedly test people, and in the context of quarantine timelines. So if you get a test, do you really need to quarantine for that period of time? And when can you know it's safe? And so I think, you know, not to be the person who always talks about statistics, but actually it's super useful if you think about managing COVID, which we're in the long haul for if you think about that in the context of like your risk diet or risk tolerance, then these numbers really matter. And it's nice to see people like trying to dig in and actually understand the risk. I will say, just like a side plug, the other thing I think that is getting increased attention, and I'm glad to see it, and I myself have been spending more attention on it, is the supply chain and like what that means realistically for, even if we develop a vaccine, logistically, what does that mean for delivery in terms of who can be rolled out and what do we need to get ready? And I think often we don't think a lot about logistics, and right now people are, and that's heartening to see. Their lives and economic conditions depend on it, but still good to see.
Well, I was going to say we could also agree on the importance of finding common vernacular for sensitivity and specificity.
Oh my God.
Because yeah. I believe I call those reliability and accuracy, but I, you know, anyway, that's very confusing across the assorted statistical disciplines. There's no reason for these words, which all have identical connotations, to have distinct denotations. It's completely pointless.
Well, often there are different ratios of combinations of the same things, which is extra helpful just for confusion. Anyway.
Yeah, you can't see me making a face at Rada here as we record this, but I was just appalled. Anyway, my stories are maybe, I don't know, more focused on our regular topics than you guys, one of which is just a general focus on human security as opposed to national security. And we've talked about that a bit on the show over the years. It's something that I have, for the most part, been very resistant to. I never liked that language around human security, often because I felt like it sort of dressed up issues that I wasn't particularly interested in. But I think you know, as you hear about it, both in campaign rhetoric, not just at the national level, but in local races as well, but also just from, you know, average voters or average, you know, U.S. residents who are talking about, you know, how is it that we spend all of this money or all this effort to, quote, protect the nation, but we haven't protected the citizens from this particular threat? And I think it does force a very interesting conversation amongst foreign policy and national security professionals in terms of what actually are we supposed to be protecting the population from, and how do we best do that, which I think is a very interesting question. And then, of course, and just in the last few days, there's been a number of interesting pieces on the 25th Amendment. And I think there's easy to do those in sort of snide ways. But there's actually some very real questions about continuity of government. And, you know, if and when perhaps the president is receiving experimental treatments or is under the influence of some powerful, you know, treatments or cocktails of drugs, you know, what are the conditions under which he should voluntarily hand over some of those commander-in-chief duties or other signatory authorities to members of the cabinet or the vice president? I'm not a lawyer. I don't know the answer to that question, but it strikes me as like, you know, we have powers of attorney for normal, you know, American citizens, right? And if you think that you aren't able to be, you know, able to exercise those duties, you know, a board of directors at a publicly traded company would likely have an opinion about how their CEO being, you know, under such treatments and the decisions they were allowed to make therein. So it just, it's an interesting set of questions that I think we haven't thought through very well and haven't talked about as very much in like normal times. And now we have to do it in a very partisan, charged, borderline crisis type environment. And that's a bummer for rational discussion.
It's interesting you bring this up. I think this falls into this broader category of things that I have learned over the course of the last, you know, 3.5 years or so of how many things are sort of underdefined by law or rules and like relied so much on norms. Like you would think that, like one might think that in government, like in a range of situations, there are just conditions under which your legal authority is legally binding, right? Like there are conditions under which you can't be like, you can't be signing contracts if you showed up to your, to a lawyer's office completely incapacitated, or there are arguments to be made that it could be invalid if somebody tried to get you to sign them under treatment at a hospital, right? Like there are all sorts of situations where we have this defined, and you know, there's a range of things like this in the government. And I guess I'm surprised is probably not the right word, but I find it interesting how underdefined and how reliant on norms so many of these things that are like the undergird our like system of government really are.
The other aspect of that, Radha, that I think is interesting is there's so many things that were meant to, that when generated were meant to be used frequently, but because we haven't used them frequently, they're seen as like a big deal. So 25th Amendment is one that, I mean, I don't know how frequently it's meant to be used, but I think more frequently than extremely rarely. Or impeachment, something else that you might have expected would be used more often. Shutting down the government, censoring people within government. Like there's lots of more punitive tools that, or suing one another in government, more punitive tools that were meant to be like, no, we really mean it. Please don't do that. Like, seriously, don't do that. That are seen as like super escalatory now and a big deal. So therefore you don't actually ever want to pursue them. And as a result, we haven't tested out. What do we feel comfortable with in terms of the 25th Amendment or shutting down government or impeachment or things like that? They seem like a huge deal at this point. And that's understandable to a degree, but as a result, like they're so escalatory and so uncomfortable that you don't ever have those useful conversations ahead of time.
I think there is an element to the degree to which so much of what we require in a nation of laws, right? The rule of law requires people to essentially submit to the rule of law, even without coercion, right? Not every law is enforced at the point of a gun. Compliance with laws, compliance with, you know, overarching legal norms is a feature of democracy, right? If everything has to be enforced through violence, whether by the state or someone else, that, you know, moves toward fascism very, very quickly. And so I think a lot of what we're seeing right now is sort of, you know, like the 1820s, you know, Jackson administration, you know, you've made your ruling, let's see you enforce it, right? They're sort of like, I double dog dare you to actually do something about our refusal to comply with ethics laws or, you know, these other sorts of things. And yeah, like there's actually not that much enforcement power when the executive, who's meant to enforce all of those laws, refuses to comply with them or enforce them himself. So, yeah, that's a real challenge. And I think it is deserving of greater attention. And, you know, we may need stricter pieces in place. You know, perhaps we'll get them legislatively, you know, going forward. Who knows? Kind of a related question. So that question was about, like, what's getting more attention? Maybe we can think about policies or trends that are receiving some advancement or acceleration under COVID. That weren't maybe getting the policy oomph or public attention or public pressure that they were before. Do we have, I have one example here that I can sort of think about, but I'm wondering if you guys have thoughts on what's been pushed forward that might not have been outside this COVID era.
A really obvious one is telehealth. Not only in terms of accessibility, there has been actual policy and legislative changes, particularly around government-provided healthcare, like for veterans, that have enabled them to access telehealth for a lot of things, including mental health services that they weren't able to do before. A lot of that infrastructure was there at the time, but particularly under COVID, like I know the VA and others got very quick responses from Congress to be able to say, look, if we can't provide mental health services or we can't provide these other services, we need to be able to legally provide them virtually in some way. And Congress is pretty responsive on that. I know some insurance providers have been decently responsive on some versions of that, and others are still kind of slowed on the uptake on that. But I mean, I was thinking the other day, might have been amongst this group that we were talking about, like, virtual counseling services and how much easier that is in some ways to think about accessing than it is to have to go to get an appointment, show up at somebody's office, go up the stairs, wait till your name's called. There's just like a barrier level to that that's diminished. And particularly for veterans who are so often accessing care through VA centers that are often quite far away from their homes, that's a real advancement in terms of their ability to access care that they need.
I've done all of my therapy appointments for the last 6 months via video on my off Fridays largely. And I'm kind of, you know, the office is not very far from my house, but I'm kind of wondering why I would ever go back to doing it in person necessarily. You know, when I was sick this summer, I did all of my interaction with my primary care doc through, you know, email, secure email and their own platform. And what's interesting is that my primary care doc had invested in that infrastructure previously, but the therapy group basically finally felt they need to do the push to sign up for the service and to get the secure protocols and to get everyone trained to do it properly. And my therapist actually noted that Australia has long had a significant number of advancements in telehealth because it's so remote. And if you're outside of the major metropolitan areas on the coast, they've long had to do this. So I think that's a great example of places where the technology has been in place for some time and been available, but there haven't been the financial incentives either from the supply or the demand side for practices to invest in it. So
it's like you're an economist on the inside.
Look, Radha, I care about organizations and incentives. I just don't believe in perfect information. Okay. What's your example?
So my example is actually like pretty related to this discussion, which is cybersecurity generally. And like, I think talking about the full range of cybersecurity, right? So like, you know, with increasingly putting stuff on the internet, everything from medical information and doing that work to voting and election cyber, I don't know that we've resolved a lot of issues, but we're actually starting to have much more robust discussions on like, what is cyber hygiene and what do people need to do at like their sort of point of use? What are things we need to expect from the networks? Like, what are things we should worry about in terms of adversarial actions and who should be worried about that? What are different kinds of, right? Like, so it's just a much more robust discussion because so much of our life is dependent on online and there are so many different ways that that can go wrong. And I think in some ways, you know, that discussion has been a long time in coming and, you know, a lot of our lives were online and a lot of this information was online. We just weren't really aware of it in the same way because we also had the in real life interactions. And I think now when you have your doctor's appointment online, you also think, oh, all of this information is transmitted online. It might've been before and they had to invest in this, but we're now starting to have those conversations. And I think that's probably, well, I hope, knock wood, that a silver lining to this is that will serve us well in the future. But also at least it makes everyone part of the conversation on this sort of like election, for instance, cybersecurity and online threats.
But you guys are like so smart and it's Fai's fault. You should have a podcast or something. I mean, seriously. It's funny because, you know, we you know, do these brainstorms ahead of the show and I try to like think of my thing and I'm like, well, that's it. I mean, we're going to be in a world of hurt when they come up with the same thing. And we never come up with all the same thing. We actually all come up with different things. And I don't know why I'm surprised by that every time, but I am. And it's so delightful. Mine are actually around flexible work arrangements and childcare. Like childcare as a national good, as a public good, which as someone who was in, you know, whose parents made avail, you know, made use of every possible childcare arrangement when I was small, and whose, you know, siblings, you know, do as well, not to mention, you know, you guys who have actual children, unlike me, but the workforce doesn't work regardless of your gender, if there is not a safe and, you know, kind of reputable place to stash your kids for 8 hours a day. I mean, they've got to learn some stuff, I guess, but mostly they have to be kept, you know, occupied, entertained, fed, and warm, you know, for several hours a day. And nothing works if that doesn't happen.
Basically, every weekend, I am reminded that I'm just like not that creative a human. And like, I have 2 days to fill up and I have no idea what to do. I'm like, should we run around in circles outside? Let's run around in circles outside. Oh, it's 40 degrees. No problem. Wear socks. You don't have mittens. Wear socks on your hands. It's fine. Run around.
That's true. Absolutely.
And then our childcare provider, who is frankly, I think just like the best thing that is going on in my life right now in 2020, shows up with like activities and plans. And I was just like, wow, how do you come up with these things? So anyway, I agree. I'm constantly reminded how impossible it would be for me to function in my job and in my life if I didn't have childcare. And I'm very fortunate in that. And it's, you know, I think we've seen it in the numbers that there are disparate impacts to not having childcare, and the burden disproportionately falls on women and they disproportionately exit the labor force.
The statistics from this week on women exiting the labor force were
horrific.
Horrific. I mean, real, you know, as people who both in our specific professional lives, but I think also more broadly have worked to try to make at least our field more open to women. I'm sure there are some covariance in terms of income and skill level, but I mean, I see it, you know, across white collar jobs. I see it, you know, and struggling with people struggling, even folks who do have some childcare who haven't left the labor force, they'll leave the labor force out of sheer burnout. I mean, there is just some absolutely, you know, appalling, you know, just difficult situations out there, to say nothing of the importance of special education and kids who have IEPs at school and the challenges their parents are experiencing. So, I mean, all of this is to say we should pay teachers more. We should invest in childcare centers as real public goods. And I hope that we advance part of that conversation as part of, not as part of a like nonsense work-life balance conversation, but really in terms of, you know, the basic infrastructure that's needed to have healthy and productive working families. Do we have other policy pieces? Are there other stories? Are there other wonky things to flag or highlight before we shift gears here slightly?
I don't know if this counts as a policy one, but one question I had that's sort of related to an early one about distracting, what is COVID distracting from, is what has COVID erased altogether, either literally or by all appearances? My policy answer to that is North Korea.
Hmm.
I mean, think about what you might have expected North Korea to do this year, possibly the last year of a Trump presidency. They don't know. In order to advance their agenda in some way. And there you could in absent COVID, you can imagine more nuclear tests, you can imagine more summits. Like there's all kinds of drama that could occur in the great bromance between Kim Jong-un and President Trump, probably as a result of COVID. You've heard very little from North Korea over the last several months. We can assume that there is probably pretty significant impact of the pandemic going on in the country, but we don't know much. And it might have been a very, very, very different story this year had it not been for the pandemic. I don't know if it's hard to judge if one is better or worse. They're both pretty negative all around for many reasons, but it's just a different kind of outcome.
Mine was similar to that, which is, you know, our border control policies were like a big topic for much of the time. And in the early COVID days and sort of post the U.S. being banned from everywhere in the world, we actually don't talk about like immigration in the same way and our concerns about action and use of force at the border. It's kind of almost, it's really moved the nexus of the immigrant and immigration discussion in a way that is interesting and xenophobic in an entirely different way. So it's not a cheery answer, but you know.
My other answer was going to be brunch. I'm not a huge fan of brunch anyway, but like.
Yeah, because we're too old now. But
yeah, more or less.
It's just so late and I'm so hungry by that.
And also, I can't drink that much during the middle of the day.
No, exactly. And none of us want your crappy like mimosas, as we've discussed previously. My answer would be closer to the brunch answer, Lauren, which is movies.
Oh, yeah.
Movies have been erased and we're now moving into what would be like me and my brother's, you know, favorite time of year to go like catch like, you know, all of the movies, you know, in the Oscar race and make sure we see all of the big releases. And, you know, that's just not on offer. And so for a variety of reasons, and it becomes a thing. I mean, as a person who loves seeing movies in a theater, preferably on opening night, because my FOMO is exactly what you think it is. I'm now like, under what conditions would I go back? I mean, I'll get on an airplane before I get into a movie theater at this point.
For me, like, I mean, I'm not a huge movie person and not really a movie person in the theater anyway, and I'm inclined to fall asleep in movies, so it's not a huge thing. But the lack of sports is like amazing. Like, it frees up your evening so much when other humans who your evening depends on don't have the sports ball to watch. It's great. Just great.
That's a fascinating perspective. Thank you, Radha. Okay. Lauren comes up with all of our best titles for people who don't know, because Radha and I don't have that gene. And she also comes up with most of the bombshell questions, which is probably also not surprising. So now we move into what is clearly the Lauren phase of these mm-hmm. questions, even though she also came up with all the other ones, but I feel like Radha and I kind of figured those out. But like, these are definitely hers. But we'll ease into it a little bit out of order, which is a lot of us have friends who work in international relations, either as practitioners or professors or whatnot. And there are, you know, lots of books being written about COVID and this and COVID and that. And I'm amazed that these people can put like books out or think that they have something meaningful to say 6 months into a global crisis, but whatever. What is the international relations question that you wish was being tackled instead of COVID this, COVID that? I can go first on this one.
Yeah, I confess I had a hard time coming up with like with my.
It was your question.
I know.
Well, I had two on this, which are you know basically just like my two bete noirs in general, which is one, arms control writ large, and kind of you know where are we? How like what are we thinking about like large missiles in the world these days? Do we care? Do we think that there should be a limit? Who should be limited? How should we limit them? And that applies, you know, to everything from kind of the collapse or our withdrawal from the INF treaty to if and how we should bring China into any of the arms limitation treaties, what to do with North Korea, and then, of course, the future of New START. My other one would be, you know, again, kind of the big IR questions, like COVID is a subset of what do we do about major power competition under conditions of globalization, right? So this gets to some of the supply chain questions we've talked about before, but you know, in general, you know, whether or not you want to call this the China plague, China plays a critical role in both the origination of this particular outbreak, but also the control of this outbreak, and is now, you know, has certainly is in a you know day to day better shape the United States in terms of its numbers. Hard to believe exactly all of its numbers, but they are orders of magnitude less than ours in terms of deaths and cases. They would now, you know, there are limitations on U.S. travel going into China, right? To say, you know, as opposed to the reverse, which is sort of shocking at the end of the day. Yeah. So, you know, what does, you know, we need a certain amount of global cooperation, for example, on COVID, but also on a bunch of other topics, like potentially artificial intelligence, or as I said before, arms control, or global climate change. What do those look like when you have two powers that are, while economically intertwined, clearly at diplomatic and potentially military loggerheads?
So I decided to take a broad brush at this question.
Excellent.
Mine is, and the piece of the conversation I think is missing is, how do different countries' approaches to staffing their government generate, have they generated differences in the effectiveness of their COVID responses? So both in terms of like, what does your civil service look like? Mm-hmm. What is the integration of like scientific experts and academic communities into your government? How do advisors get in and like provide policymaking decisions? What types of benefits do you have for people to be able to work remotely, have childcare, have healthcare, right? And I think all of those played a part in really shaping who is serving and who is being listened to in the US, in the UK, in European countries, and in a handful of Asian countries. And I think there are probably meaningful differences out there that I would like to understand better.
You could like get a whole dissertation, do a whole PhD on that, Rod. Like, would you like to do another one?
Yeah.
Somebody take that. Go. Yeah. Go for it.
I can do a project on that.
I know you can. I've been meaning to raise it with you the other day when I was reading about the differences between Sweden's response and other responses. Guys, I secretly read about personnel policy when I'm taking breaks from work.
That's amazing. I love that so much. It makes me so happy.
But I do think like there's this like how we cultivate a workforce and like science and research into that workforce is just really distinct in different countries and not something I think we talk enough about. And like this particular element, I was most recently struck by, you know, Ireland is going back into another lockdown phase. And it's kind of early given like the increase. And I think basically they have a theory of some combination of public health communications and compliance. Well, I know they do, this is just actively discussed, in which they're basically trying to have a harsher lockdown now when they think people will comply, rather than an increased ratcheting set of lockdowns should the rates go up, under the theory that they can basically like whack it back down, rack the rates back down really hard rather than sort of keep them manageable and controlled. And that is like a difference in public health discussion. And things like that are just, they have real consequences both to how the government operates and the outcomes we see, and we don't talk about them enough.
I found that fascinating. I'll build off of Aaron's a bit. I mean, I think the great power competition, national innovation strategy, national technology strategy, there's a lot of buzz around all of these right now. And it's funny, whenever I go into two kinds of conversations on them broadly. Those who think that developing a national innovation strategy or a national technology strategy is easy, and like all we need to do is figure out our priority technologies and just like start investing in them and protecting them and so on. And those who recognize that like, this is getting into a zero-sum game to a degree where we are competing over a limited number of goods and limited number of limited market access, such that we're going to have to like picking winners amongst ourselves. We're going to have to start harming allies in terms of like whose industries are up and whose are down. And you're also going to have to develop processes for like when you decide to like get rid of Huawei, which we don't have a process for that. We just kind of did it and said that we don't
sort
actually.
Of.
Huh?
Sort of.
Right. Yeah. Not we successfully did so. We just decided that we like don't like Huawei and don't want them around. And there's no comparable national security infrastructure to any of those questions in the United States right now. It's totally lacking. And people who think it exists or think it could be built up easily are sort of missing a lot of points. And anyway, I find those to be interesting. In a different kind of equation of the question that I asked about books that I would want to be written right now or questions I want to be answered right now. If we had like a normal functioning national security system right now, I would love to see how it's operating when it's not getting much attention, because it's not right now. Like the healthcare part, well, it should be. In theory, the healthcare part of our US government is getting much more attention than the national security. Whereas like in the Obama administration, if the national security advisor calls up the president and says like, we need to have a meeting on something today, he says yes. Usually, like that's just how it works. Like it always draws UN, sucks UN, sucks up everybody's energy. If they don't have that, what do they do? How do they live? What do they manage to run by themselves? Do they focus on other issues? I don't know.
That is an excellent question, but not as interesting a question as the following, which is which skill has been stolen from you during the COVID-19 crisis? I know what mine is.
What's yours?
Sleep.
Oh, yeah. You have totally failed on sleep.
but also conversely waking up. So I can neither sleep nor wake up properly. I am completely unfit to returning to a normal office environment at any time in the future. So, but sleep is by far the piece that has been stolen the most.
I've lost the ability to make small talk. I can do it like on Zoom is okay. I'm not sure why. Maybe Zoom doesn't really feel like small talk, but like whenever, and the few times that I have to engage with people in person, it's sort of like, what is this strange alien creature that I'm engaging with?
It also feels really weird to like say in an email, I hope you had a great weekend. No one had a great weekend.
No.
Everyone's weekend was really weird and kind of like middling. So that's like a very bizarre, you know, piece.
And I think my other one, this is harder to describe. Like, I'm terrible at my to-do list now, but I'm even worse in the seeing big projects end-to-end at this moment. Like, because everything just feels so disconnected. Like, you don't see people in the same way. You're only engaging in projects through your computer screen. Like, you're never, like, having big in-person conversations with people about them. It's just very, I don't know. There's a lot of discontinuity in my life, it feels like.
So mine is like, sounds ridiculous, but it's like movement that is not exercise. I feel like in a normal life, I would like walk to things. I'd walk around and go on walks to think about things. I might walk with someone and talk with them. Like I do none of those things. I like might go for a run, maybe the best case scenario. And then I sit at my desk and maybe like go to my kitchen to make coffee or lunch and then go back to my desk. Like, it's just so much more confined. I don't commute anywhere. I don't go anywhere. Like, again, like I might like have a dedicated, like take my kid and dog on a walk. But other than that, like there's just no ancillary movement. And sometimes I just feel like I like have the wiggles. Like, it's just anyway.
You and your small children both, you know, yes.
You do, yeah.
Conversely, yeah. What skill have you gained from COVID?
Guys, I got really into meal planning.
Into what?
Meal planning. This is very rada. Like what I really enjoy doing is on Sundays, I sit down and I plan out everything I'm going to eat for every meal in the week. And then I buy all of the ingredients at the grocery store. And then I have a like really varied set of meal. And I've been like buying different cookbooks to try to cook different kinds of food. And it's actually very satisfying. Like I wouldn't say I spend actually that much more time cooking food, but it is amazing what like, if you spend the time to like look into recipes and cook, the things you can make that are relatively tasty.
So one, I hate you so much right now. And two, can I please subscribe to your service?
Yes.
Okay.
I feel like meal planning is just like, I don't know why I haven't been doing this all this time. I love planning. I love meals. It involves lists and a schedule. Like, this is made for me.
This is so Rada. I love it. Lauren, what is yours?
I have two. One, I mean, Rada has always been very good at audio books, listening to books on tape. I've always been terrible at that, and I've totally picked it up in the last 4 months. I don't know why. Like, I can read a book just as easily as I could otherwise, but just for some reason,
it's
having
more interactive. I think.
I guess
like
so. Yeah.
Another person you're interacting with.
So I'm doing a lot more of that. And the other one that I also know Rada is big into now these days is brow. Grooming is not the right word because that would imply that I'm doing actively engaged in my brows. Much more adding product to my eyebrows, I suppose, is my other skill that I've engaged in.
I do not need product in my brows. The only product in my brows that I need is wax. And that has been woefully lacking. I think that my skill that I have gained is road tripping, like by myself. So, you know, I traveled all the way home and then to Colorado and then all the way back this summer. And I've now gone up to Maine in one shot and we'll come back. Part of it's that like without traffic, Rada, you will appreciate this. We have reduced both the average time it takes to travel, but also the variance around mm-hmm. that average. And that is deeply satisfying. So as opposed to a trip along I-95 taking between 8 and 14 hours, it now takes, you know, definitely 9. And that is much more easy for a, you know, person driving alone to be able to manage and plan out. So
turns out also for a person with two small children. I totally agree. I think the lack of variance in travel planning is like a really big benefit.
It's huge. And so now instead of flying anywhere, you know, and I guess, you know, a corollary to that, I wouldn't say it's a skill, but it is definitely an advantage. You know, what would have been weekend trips on airplanes are now week-long trips bracketed by drives. That's kind of an interesting old-timey sort of thing in some ways. So I guess we've got that going for us. Okay, last general set of questions, and then I guess we can do a little bit of pop culture if we so desire, if we've consumed any. What is your best COVID purchase / decision?
Steam cleaner. No question. Oh God, it's made me so happy.
It's great, steam right? Cleaner. I have a lot of steam cleaning tips that I would like to impart to you.
I can't wait to hear them. And then I mean, during the summer, my weighted blanket was less exciting, but now I've brought it back into my life and it's making me happy again.
Yes, I struggled with the weighted blanket as well in the summer, and now I don't love it on my bed exactly, but it's very nice on the couch on my insomniac nights when I'm like vaguely trying to get back to sleep. To get under that on the couch is very satisfying.
I have taken to investing in expensive various masks for my hair and skin, including a charcoal hair mask, which I would highly recommend, as well as Olaplex, which again, highly recommend, especially if you're the third person who dyes your roots, because you can put the root dye on and then the Olaplex on your ends, and then you wash it out and your hair is just like amazing. So generally I would say like hair and skin investment, but at present I've gone long on hair investment and I feel like it's really paying off, you know, so that my toddlers can be impressed by.
I mean, your hair looks amazing right now.
Yeah. I mean,
it's 10:30 at night on a Monday. I'm not really sure why.
My hair does not look amazing. I mean, I have previously invested in thinning shears. I actually have a whole set of clippers when they became available again in like July. I scooped them up, but I have not done the DIY hair. Unlike Lauren, who has and looks completely fabulous.
Oh, she's
channeling. Very twiggy, I feel.
Mm-hmm. I've got very sides, undercut, thinned out pixie situation. I'm never paying for this stuff again.
Right? I mean, I go to the barber shop and I pay $20 and I don't
know.
Guys,
I'm like 1,000% going to pay for someone to highlight and cut my hair.
I struggled with what my best, you know, purchase or decision was. I mean, I think probably my best decision was spending a month at my sister's house with my nieces, which was just awesome and hilarious and really a gift that keeps on giving. The other night I was on just FaceTime because I'm no longer there with my youngest niece, and she was like doing all of this craft project and she was gluing all these like popsicle sticks together or something. And, you know, she had propped up the phone and I said, well, be careful. Don't get glue all over your desk. And she says, without even looking up, not my desk, and continues about her project. And so, you know, that's pretty hard to argue with. I did successfully purchase a bike at the beginning of lockdown, which I've ridden fairly often, and I enjoy riding, and I'm glad that I purchased that. Part of it's like I have purchased so many random things, to include nice sheets, a pineapple stuffed animal, I mean, a new bed for the guest room. I mean, like, there's a lot of household goods and probably like 50 plants that have been purchased in the last 6 months. So it's a little hard to narrow it down.
It's true.
Radha, like, I feel like I want liner. You.
They're so great.
I want, Radha, you to develop some sort of measure of randomness for an Amazon order. So like the most disparate things in one order gets you like some sort of like bonus prize, because I feel like I would be competitive in that category.
Oh, interesting. I was wondering if it was just like you go to your Amazon cart and you randomize which things get delivered and then see if you notice the things that don't deliver.
I would 100% be able to like, would love to do that. Like just deliver me 3 every week and we'll see how long it takes to like empty the cart. Oh, we're brilliant. We should definitely do this on our own. Do we have pop culture? Kind of, not really. It's getting hard, right? Like it's...
I mean, the problem is, I'm not going to lie, the news took up my whole weekend.
Right. Yes.
So, and I just feel like if they're going to execute all of the plots, like not just in a year, but just like in the course of 4 days, that I'm going to need like full shutdown for everything else.
I remember when the OC premiered and they burned through all of Beverly Hills 90210's plot lines in like half of the first season. And I was like, well, what else is there? And then there was like 2.5 more seasons. That's what I feel like right now in terms of like.
I know. It's just like every like 3 minutes was a story. I have to say that the night that the president's diagnosis was announced, I went to bed early and I woke up the next morning. And basically just like after that, I was I don't understand how I'm supposed to function with this level of consumption.
But on the flip side, I spent 8 hours on a mountain in New Hampshire on Sunday, and nothing materially had changed when we came back. So it's not useful to like be on it and in the minute of it. Like you can totally take 12, 24, 480 hour breaks, and like the real actual meaningful impact has mostly, you know, evaporated.
I will say that on the heels of my Lady Detective series, I started this Royal Spyness series, which has some excellent one-liners on what is done and not done in, you know, upper crust societies that just kind of ring through my head. And I frequently want to be like, you just don't bury a body in the back garden. It's simply not done. It's too easy.
The analogy that came to mind for me of all this news consumption is it feels like, Radha, you'll remember this time, like when you have a 3-month-old and they're sick for the first time, you're monitoring their symptoms constantly. Like what's their temperature? How are they breathing? Are they coughing? And so on and so on. And like, you're totally freaked out about it and just like constantly engaged. But at the end of the day, like it doesn't change that much, or just sort of like you feel like you're supposed to. But I did the same thing over the weekend. Like we went hiking, we were at wineries, like
right now,
all the same a few hours later. The only media, so we consumed, I think it was the day that the president's taxes came out that we started watching the Great British Bake Off, which is no longer a bake off. It's now like the baking show or something. And even though it doesn't have Mary Bear anymore, it was still quite delightful. Quite delightful. Like all of it was just very sort of soothing to the soul. And because the president was at Bethesda Naval Medical Institute, which is now Walter Reed, which is super confusing.
So confusing.
But, yeah, I picked up my my books about the first daughter who was kidnapped and then spends time at Bethesda. Picked it up to read again because, I don't know, just felt like fun. It's a young adult book from like the early 90s, and it's pretty terrible, but it's also just great to read at the same time.
I have nothing to contribute here. I feel like I haven't consumed no interesting pop culture. There's some stuff on the horizon. Perhaps we'll do a more dedicated like fall pop culture preview in our next engagement.
Back to
school reading. Yeah, because we're going to have the new Mandalorian pretty soon.
Yep. Yep. Well, we should have Witcher has more episodes coming soon. I mean, there's The Crown will be back in November. So we have.
Oh, Aaron, you watched the new Sherlock show. What did you think of that?
Oh, the Enola Holmes. Mm-hmm. It's fine. It's delightful. There's no reason not to watch it. Like it's like bubblegum for your soul. It's perfection unless you're like deeply invested in Sherlock Holmes, in which case you will object. But
I don't know what that means. But is it?
You'll like it fine, Radha.
The Holmes estate was so deeply invested in Sherlock Holmes that they objected to the show because they did not like Sherlock having emotions in the show.
Yeah. It's actually better if you don't think of it as being Sherlock related at all. Like that adds nothing to the actual plot other than it makes you want to watch it.
That's my kind of jam.
Yeah, you're going to like it just fine. So, all right, ladies, I think thus ends our fantastic recap of all the crazy things that are happening while we're obsessed with the president's health. And hopefully we'll have a little bit more normal conversation the next time we meet. But who knows? Until then, goodbye.
Bye.